You're listening to the Family Matters Podcast, brought to you by the Montana Family Foundation. Join Derek A. Straker and Patrick Webb weekly for faith-fueled conversations about pressing issues, current events, and politics in the Big Sky State. When it comes to faith and freedom, family really matters. Welcome back to the Family Matters Podcast. Derek A. Straker in studio, as always, with Patrick Webb. How are you doing, Patrick?
Doing great today, Derek. How are you?
I'm well. I'm excited for a couple reasons. For listeners that don't know, my wife is pregnant right now, very pregnant. We are expecting any day now, and this is our third child together. We are going to be surprised this time around. We don't know if it's a boy or a girl. We're excited to find out what we're having. So excited about that. Also excited that we're doing an episode on parental rights today. And there's a lot to cover there. But just talking in our pre-show dialogue as we do, this covers so much ground, and there's so much to talk about historically, currently. What are your initial thoughts here, Patrick?
Well, it feels like we've probably touched on this subject, if not even dug into it a little bit before, but I think we had some kind of different ideas about how we could dig into this in a different way, especially talking about kind of the history from a very limited history of parental rights, and especially kind of what our founding fathers thought about that and some of the influential minds of the day that they were looking to, kind of how they viewed this. I think that's really important because oftentimes we think that these are new debates and arguments and problems that we're facing today, when if we just actually dug into history a little bit more and, you know, read and actually learned some of these things, we'd realize that there were some very smart people a long time ago that had these debates, and we have a lot to learn from them, and we need to learn from them because there's, you know, a lot at stake. I mean, the future of our children, the future of our country, the future of so much is at stake, and it impacts so many issues. I think it is a deciding issue that affects so many other issues about whether or not, like, what is the role of parental rights? What are the limits? Right. And just everything involving that. So it's a super important topic.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, it's timely in the sense that it's a hot topic today. I mean, for a number of reasons, and you touched on this, but think about it in the context of school choice. You know, do parents have a right to, you know, choose the best educational option for their child, or for their children? Can it differ between children? You know, what about the books that they're consuming in a library? You know, do parents have a right to object to certain content that their children have access to? Can they consent to or withhold consent from certain medical procedures or medical therapies? Or alleged medical therapies? Do parents have a right to withhold their consent or give their consent for abortion? Parental rights covers a lot of ground. But before we jump into some of these kind of modern issues with parental rights, I think it's important, especially for our listeners who probably are aware to some extent of the parental rights movement, I think it's important that we know where this kind of started. I mean, obviously, our belief system, as a Judeo-Christian organization, we believe all of our rights come from God. To the extent they're codified in a constitution or statute somewhere, I think the starting block is from our Creator, and you and I agree on that, and I think our listeners do as well. And then you have this concept that's tossed out from time to time, the concept of natural law. And I think we should we should start with a, just, we don't need to dive into the philosophy too much, mm-hmm. but natural law as a concept is kind of the genesis for the parental rights movement even today. And it started, you know, almost 1,000 years ago with Thomas Aquinas, who, you know, we're talking 1200s here. Mm-hmm. So the 13th century. And we talk about natural law, the idea of natural law. It holds that all people, no matter their ethnicity, their culture, religion, no matter what, they can know the difference between good and evil, right and wrong. So at the heart of it, there are just certain things that we all can accept naturally as true. And one example would be the golden rule that we often hear about, you know, especially when we're little, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The golden rule. You know, proponents of natural law will say, well, look, this is something, this is a concept just that naturally all humans can accept mm-hmm. as true. So, you know, just by way of example. So when you apply that to parental rights, you know, proponents of natural law would say that parental rights and a parent's right and authority over their children is just something that all human beings can embrace naturally, can recognize and acknowledge naturally.
Yeah, it's endowed by our Creator. And so the way that I think our founders thought about this was they were coming from a monarchy, a system where a king had divine right and a divine authority to basically grant rights to the peoples of his land. And so the founders saw an inherent problem in that, because just because he, you know, said that he was had divine authority and divine power, it didn't stop him from being corrupt. It didn't stop him from oppressing the people. And so they did not want that system of government. And they were looking to people like John Locke, who was considered the father of liberalism. Now, this is classical liberalism. Maybe
not today's,
liberals. The word has been hijacked and destroyed in many ways, which is very unfortunate. But our founders were absolutely, you know, considered classical liberals, in that they believed that these rights were not something that were to be given by a king, but that they were natural and that they're given to us by God. And there is no man on earth that can take that from us, even if they say that they have that claim as king, president, whatever it may be.
Right. Right. And so from these philosophers like Aquinas and John Locke, you know, in this country, at least, we have, you know, there are court cases out there that talk about a deeply rooted history in this country, tradition in this country that, and I'll quote here from one U.S. Supreme Court case, Washington v. Glucksberg from 1997, that, quote, parents have a right to direct the education and upbringing of their children, end quote. There's definitely recognition of a parental right beyond debate enduring in our American tradition to direct the upbringing, education of your children. There's also case law out there that talks about making medical decisions on behalf of your children. But our courts have taken a deep dive into, you know, kind of the framework of parental rights. And they've really looked at this, you know, I'll be using a lot of quotes here today,
yeah.
Patrick, because I'm citing to case law.
Mm-hmm.
There's another case, a very, very famous case from the U.S. Supreme Court called Troxell v. Granville. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court framed parental rights in terms of a, quote, decisional framework. So in other words, it was who has the responsibility to make decisions on behalf of a child, okay? And courts have long acknowledged that parents possess the primary and ultimate decision-making authority with respect to their own children. There are instances in which, you know, a parent can lose those parental rights. Those parental rights can be terminated. But by and large, the general rule here is that parents have broad parental authority over their minor children. And courts have taken a look at, well, where does that come from? It's essentially a recognition of a parent's authority to make decisions on behalf of or affecting their children, even when others, including the government or the state, might disagree with those decisions. The rights of parents are properly examined based upon who has that ultimate decision-making authority. If you do it any other way, and you know, I think modern liberals often look at children differently than you or I. You know, they don't look at it in terms of this decision-making authority. You know, we've heard Joe Biden and Kamala Harris refer to children as our children. You know, we all have a responsibility. It takes a village. You know, these types of ideas that children are kind of wards of the state or property of the state to some extent. They're a resource of the state. And if parents aren't in line with the state's ideas about the best interests of those children, then the parents need to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in instances where you have secret gender transitions of children mm-hmm. in schools. You have children being removed from their parents' home if their parent or their parents don't want to transition them from one gender to another. You know, this type of, I guess, looking at a parent's role over their child, not in a decision-making framework, but in a children are a resource of the state framework,
mm-hmm.
that it can lead to these dangerous results, really shocking results.
Right. And the difference between, you know, a parent, set of parents versus the state is that in the court in Parham v. J.R. of 1979, they said that most important is that historically it is recognized that natural bonds of affection lead parents to act in the best interests of their children. And we don't see that, whether it's, you know, teachers who care deeply for our kids. I mean, we've had some awesome teachers with our kids, and it, you know, especially in our circles, conservative leaning circles, you know, it's even seen sometimes as being taboo if you have kids in the public school district. But, you know, I'm happy to say that, like, we do have our kids enrolled in the school district where we live. And I've been very involved with the school board and trying to make sure that I'm comfortable with the things that are being taught, very involved in our children's upbringing. And the kids and the administrators that I've met with personally and talked with, they care deeply for our kids. And we're not seeing that they're trying to push an ideology. Now I know that that's not the case, you know, across the country and even across Montana. I know that we're seeing that in some school districts in Montana, but there is no comparison between the parent who really has a natural bond of affection that is not similar to a teacher or public officials like Kamala Harris or Joe Biden. They do not have the same level of care that a parent has. And the courts recognize that.
Right, right. And in the Parham case, it's Parham v. J.R. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case. I'm so glad that's awesome. You're doing some case law research, buddy. they recognize natural bonds of affection lead parents to act in the best interest of their children.
Mm.
But what they also recognize, because there's two assumptions that lead a court to accept this decision-making framework
mm.
as to why parental rights exist in the first place. Number one is the natural bonds of affection. You know, if you have kids, you understand what the court's talking about there. You just naturally love your kids.
Yeah, it's like something in our DNA. I mean, I always heard that the reason our babies look so cute and that they smell good to parents is because nature wants to make sure that we take good care of them and that we don't go crazy from sleepless nights and harm them. which, you know, can happen in awful circumstances. But generally speaking, parents are very drawn to taking great care of their children.
I love my kids. I want to give them all the best. I know you do too. And that's the case for most parents. Those natural bonds of affection, the state, the government, the courts assume that that exists between a child. The other thing that they assume exists is that parents, and this is another quote from the Parham case, quote, parents possess what a child lacks in maturity, experience, and capacity for judgment required to make life's difficult decisions, end quote. Well, that's a given, right? Mm-hmm. I've lived longer than my 3-year-old son. I have a little more maturity. My wife would say a little more maturity than my 3-year-old son. I have more experience and I have more capacity to make good decisions. That's my role, is to help him make those decisions. You know, if my son believes that he can drive our vehicle, he's 3 years old. Number one, there's laws that are against that. And number two, he doesn't have the maturity, the experience, or the capacity to make good decisions behind the wheel of a vehicle. So that's why I drive. And I also can't put him behind the wheel and give him instruction as to how to drive, because he just doesn't have the maturity, experience, and capacity to make good decisions behind the wheel, even if I'm just riding shotgun with him. Yep. So there's certain things that, you know, I guess that brings us into our next point here with parental rights, that yes, courts and our history and our tradition recognize parental rights with broad authority over our, over children. You know, we have broad authority, but there are limits mm-hmm. to that authority. Mm-hmm. And I use the example of driving a vehicle, a child, a 3-year-old boy driving a vehicle. But there are other examples to highlight the limits of parental authority. Do parents, based on their broad parental authority, have the right or even the option to provide alcohol or illicit drugs to an 8-year-old child? Mm-hmm. The answer is no. Do parents have the right to, you know, have their child go in and an 8-year-old child go in and get a tattoo? Well, you know, these are the types of questions that become relevant today, especially when we talk about the transgender movement. You know, because for all that our conservative, social conservative movement has done for parental rights, there's been pushback from the other side that, well, you can't have it both ways. You can't have all this broad parental authority and then tell, you know, progressive or woke parents that they don't have the right to transition their child mm-hmm. from one gender to another, that they don't have the right to take their child in for cross-sex hormones or puberty blockers.
Right.
So what's the answer here? Mm-hmm. You know, well, it comes back to, you know, the state does have a role in putting up some sidebars in terms of where the limits of parental authority exist. So there is some interplay between the broad parental authority that is inherent, that the courts have recognized based on those assumptions of natural bonds and parents having, you know, more experience and capacity to make good decisions and all those things. Mm-hmm. And the state's role in saying, you know, what conduct is acceptable for parents and children and society as a whole. So that's kind of the interplay there.
Yeah. And it's crazy that it's such a complicated topic, because I think that our founders even struggled with that. Alexander Hamilton is very well known for being someone in the Federalist Papers who was, you know, reiterating all these questions, well, if we're going to iterate one right, we need to go into every single right, because otherwise they're going to be taken out of context. They're going to be misconstrued and forgotten. Like, and they have been. These debates have been forgotten and lost in many ways. And because of that, we have seen radical, very dangerous ideologies, which have been on the move since the progressive era. We were just talking about our mutual disdain for Woodrow Wilson. But these are movements that have been increasing in the radical nature of an ideology that is made to appear like is what is being, what should be done in the best interest of the individual, or in the case of our kids, when in reality, it's maiming our children. It's mm-hmm. destroying their futures. And it's like this lie that has been seeded into our American system of governance. And it's just been, it's grown and it's flourished into this gigantic, monstrous creation that is now making us, it's literally making people in our society make it so that our kids can't have children in the future. Like, and I would just argue, you know, whether you're a Christian or you have a religious background or not, I think most people would say that the foundational role of being, of the foundational purpose of us living on earth and being alive is to procreate and to continue the species of humanity. And we are literally working against that now. It is like the greatest lie that has been shoved back in our face. We're harming our children and destroying their futures and eliminating the futures of children or grandchildren or future lives that they could be producing because of trying to, you know, make them feel better about some questions of identity that they have as a young person.
Yeah.
You know, before their brains are fully formed. You were just talking about capacity. Your son can't drive, not just because, you know, he can't reach the wheel and the gas at the same time, but because of the capacity of his brain. His brain is not fully developed yet. And the brains of children and adults are just so, so different. And that is a truth that we just have to accept.
It's scientifically, it's proven, Patrick, as well. I mean, and there's a difference between the sexes. You know, for female listeners out there, they mature faster. Mm-hmm. You know, they, it's just proven. Adolescent males remain pretty much adolescent males until about 25. Mm-hmm. Until about the age of 25, you know, a man's brain is still developing. And for some men, you know, that continues even beyond 25. So
yeah, and I think, like, you know, in that case, it's a choice at that point. I mean, it's always a choice, of course. There's different levels of it. But at some point, you reach the capacity to be mature, and sure. you either choose to do that or not. I mean, because there's so many adults, right, who just are not trying to help society and be responsible in their lives.
Sure. And you know, by and large, that's why states recognize an age of majority at mm-hmm. age 18. You know, that's when the state considers you to be an adult, whether or not your brain has fully developed or not. You know, there are these lines drawn in statute. And, you know, for a long history in our country, parental rights and the parental rights doctrine, at least at the U.S. Supreme Court level, was just very well settled. And that all changed in 2000 with the Troxell v. Granville decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. It kind of opened the door for individual judges and states to sort of apply their own rules to parental rights. So, you know, pre-2000, we had this parental rights doctrine that clearly established, you know, that parents have a fundamental right to direct the upbringing and education of their children. We have Troxell v. Granville in 2000. It opens the door here. And this was a Washington case out of the state of Washington. So in a nutshell, there was a Washington state law that gave any person the ability to override a good parent's decision about visitation by simply claiming that it would be best, quote, best for children to allow a third party to have visitation rights. U.S. Supreme Court reviewed this in the Troxell case. There were six separate opinions issued, and they didn't reach, you know, a five-person majority on the court. So this is what we would call a plurality opinion. And Justice Scalia was actually one of the authors of an opinion in this case, the main opinion, and he held that parents have no constitutionally protected rights whatsoever. Can you believe that? Justice Thomas, on the other hand, clearly he stated that parental rights receive the same high legal standard of protection as other fundamental rights. So the point being here that you have kind of a splintering at the U.S. Supreme Court level over, you know, what level of scrutiny to apply to fundamental parental rights, where are the lines drawn, where are the sidebars, and because the U.S. Supreme Court didn't have a unanimous or majority opinion, it was very splintered, it opened the door for individual judges and states to apply their own rules and their own constructs to parental rights. And from 2000 on to the present, that's what we've seen. And it's led to, you know, these ideologies that have considered children to be kind of the wards of the state or the property of the state, or these are our children. It's certainly led to instances in which the state is actively hiding transitions from parents. It's concealing certain things from parents in the name of protecting a child's you know, chosen identity and things like this. And it's really driven a wedge in the state, inserting itself as a wedge between parent and child. And so that's a really, you know, as a parent, that's a really scary thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something that we've worked on at the Montana Family Foundation over the years and in recent years is the concept of, you know, K through 12 sex education. You know, certainly the other side has been pushing this as an idea for quite some time. Comprehensive sexual education. They want to make sure that at age five, all the way through 12th grade, they are talking to your kids in school about sex in some form or another. They claim that it's going to be age appropriate. And you know, that's been a battle at the Montana legislature. Because, you know, there is a time to talk about sex with your kids. But historically that's been a parent's role, not the state's role. And so that's just one example of the state kind of treading on a parent's role with respect to their kids, you know, kind of inserting themselves in that first consideration by the Parham Court, which was we're gonna replace the parent's role here for having the experience and the capacity to make decisions about sex, and we're gonna go ahead and talk to your kids about these things, whether you like it or not. We're in fact gonna mandate it as part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, certainly for a lot of parents out there, you know, lines were drawn, battle lines were drawn, and we said, no, this is not right. This is not the state's role. Mm-hmm. It's the parents' role. Mm-hmm. But because of the erosion from the Troxell case in 2000, it's created some, you know, certainly some pushback and some legal challenges, either way you slice it, in the courts.
And 2020 was a big year for parental rights because we saw firsthand what the state was willing to force our children to do, to go to school. And it put a lot of parents in a hard place. And we saw a massive homeschooling revolution take place. There has been a mass exodus across the country from parents enrolling their kids in the public schools. I mean, I even see it in some of the communications for levies that are going across Montana when people are saying that, you know, we are missing out on funding because we have had a decrease in our enrollment. And that's not because we have like less kids right now. It's because more and more parents feel like their concerns are not being heard or respected in regards to their children. And they're saying, you know what, if that's the way it's going to be, I'm just going to opt out and we're not going to do this. It's really unfortunate that their tax money is still being used and taken to, you know, basically double pay for their child's education, which is an issue that we're working on. But they're answering it with, well, I'm just going to pull my kid out and we're going to do a homeschooling co-op or whatever with other parents, or a private school or whatever it may be. And in our own community of Helena, where we live, you know, we're seeing that in big ways. We're seeing Helena Christian School is looking at expanding massively because they have so much increased interest. I just went the other day last week and picked up eggs from a parent who was helping to homeschool co-op up here in Helena. And this building was filled with kids learning all kinds of really cool things and parents that were helping and taking turns teaching classes. And it was phenomenal.
Right.
It's awesome to see it. So parents are answering back one way or the other.
Well, that's right. And you're right to highlight 2020 with the pandemic and everything that went along with that. I mean, there's all sorts of things we could talk about there as well, Patrick, but parental rights, and a lot of parents out there woke up.
Mm-hmm.
Kids were coming home and doing their schoolwork at the kitchen table there with parents quarantined at home, and parents were realizing what the curriculum was that their kids were being taught, the sorts of questions that they were getting, the sorts of reading materials that they were provided, and parents were going, "Whoa, I don't like this. This needs to be different. My kids deserve better." Or my kids aren't learning the way they should be in this environment, and that woke a lot of families up. And you're right, that's just one area. You know, we talk about school choice, and certainly the response here in Montana has been, let's provide more options for parents and children to make sure kids are in the best educational environment for that specific child. I mean, that's just school choice. Mm-hmm. But parental rights are under attack everywhere you turn. Mm-hmm. It's not just in the school choice arena. It's not just in library board meetings or school board meetings where we're deciding what sorts of materials should be accessible by children in the school library or in the public library. I mean, that's an area of parental rights where children certainly are under attack, and where I guess parental indifference to the content in libraries has been taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. Up until now. We see that on a weekly basis. I mean, we could talk about, there was a recent school board hearing or a school library hearing, I think in the Billings area.
Yeah, Billings School District 2.
Yeah. So just here in the past week where we've had, you know, parental rights at center stage. Mm-hmm. Another area I would talk about is this constitutional amendment, Constitutional Initiative 128, that seeks to enshrine abortion in our Montana Constitution. The fact of the matter is, if you take a look at the actual language of this initiative, it's way more than just abortion that they're trying to enshrine in Montana. It's an attack on parental rights, because what they don't tell you, what they don't want you to know as they're going out and trying to gather signatures for this constitutional amendment, they don't want you to know that they're going to strip you of any parental right to parental consent or notice before your minor daughter undergoes an abortion procedure. They don't want you to know that that's something that's at stake. Another thing they don't want you to know is that this also touches on reproductive care. That's one of the phrases used in this initiative language, reproductive care. Think about that term, folks.
So broad.
It is so broad. It's so much more than abortion. Think about your reproductive system. You know, the fact of the matter is, cross-sex hormones, puberty blockers, and radical irreversible surgeries, those all affect your reproductive system and all could be labeled as quote unquote reproductive care. So this constitutional initiative is far broader than just abortion. And it's far broader than just pre-viability abortion. Don't let them trick you on that. But because it's unlimited abortion, any stage of pregnancy. That's what they want. But it's an attack on parental rights.
Yeah, and it's actually really scary because if you really think about how broad that term is, I mean, you could make the argument that anything you do throughout the day impacts your reproductive health. What you eat, your environment, the type of house you live in, the car you drive, the allergens that you're exposed to, the type of work you have, how much you sit in a day. I mean, so many things impact it. This seems to be what the left likes to do. They like to write the law so broad so that they can use it to advance their agenda in any way that they want to in the future. They want to open up as many possible doors as they can because it's not easy to get a constitutional initiative like this passed. And so if we're going to do it, we're going to make sure that we can open up doors to any other things that we want to do in the future.
And let me tell you, if you're a 15-year-old boy or 15-year-old girl and you have a rebellious spirit and you're not being safe with your body that God gave you, you're not treating it like a temple of the Lord, and you're engaged in premarital sex with your boyfriend or girlfriend, and your parents don't want you to be doing that, that's a part of your reproductive health. And that's another opportunity for the state or for progressive organizations like the ACLU or Planned Parenthood of Montana to drive a wedge between parents and children. It's another open door for them to be driving a wedge and an attack on parental rights and on the family unit.
Yeah, and this is why anyone who's attended our Vision of Hope presentation, I dig into Marxist ideology. Because cultural Marxism, that is what this is. I mean, that is, there's a man, his name was Alexandra Kollontai. I don't think I ever pronounced that right. It doesn't sound like a Russian name, Kollontai. I know it's got to be pronounced different. I'm going to find it someday. But he was the Soviet's first people's commissar for welfare. Hmm. And he is quoted as saying that the old family, narrow and petty, where the parents quarrel and are only interested in their own offspring, is not capable of educating the new person. And Marx, in the Communist Manifesto, he called for a new man. And they did not believe that the existing structure of the family unit was the appropriate mechanism to create that new man. And so there was very intentional subversive practices in the Soviet Union and throughout other communist countries to actually destroy the family units, to weaken them on purpose so that the state could step in and act as the guides of children. And so, you know, just as you were saying, anything that drives a wedge between children and parents, we can't just think that these are natural evolutions of political thought, that we are advancing as a species, we are living in the technological revolution, you know, the information age, we have people that are starting to, you know, think about, well, I'm going to have a computer plugged into my brain someday, potentially with Elon Musk's company. Like we're living in a strange future. I mean, and so I think it's very easy for some people to say, well, Maybe this is how it could be better. These are not new ideas. This is an ancient idea that comes, I mean, even before communism, frankly, but communism made it mainstream. And this is all I have to say about, this is what I'll end with on, you know, hitting this point on Marxism. What is the fruit of Marxism? What was the fruit of communism? Mass death, mass global death. We've talked about this many times, potentially up to what I've seen estimates, 200 million people in the 20th century from starvation, from Marxist policies, an ideology that is, you know, in many ways, I think a death cult. And so, you know, whether or not that is what is purposefully trying to advance through these, you know, policies that we're experiencing in our own state or not, it absolutely leaves open the door for people that are pushing that in our country, and they're using it. They are very active and they are using it. It's on the rise.
Well, and as Christians, we're instructed to be on guard. You know, 1 Peter 5:8 says, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. I mean, we are supposed to be on alert. Guard your family. Guard your children's eyes and their hearts. Guard your eyes and your heart. Guard your marriage. Be on alert. There's so many, and we talk about it, you know, being on alert here on this podcast, being on guard. We try to give our listeners, you know, insight into how these policy ideas and the agenda from the progressives and the cultural Marxists, how it's designed. It truly is designed. It's a goal to destroy your worldview, your faith, and replace it with their new ideology. Raise the consciousness of the oppressed. So they have to tell you that you're oppressed. You know, they create celebrated victims in this culture. That's how you get ahead now. That's how the woke mob, how you avoid the woke mob from canceling you in this cancel culture. That this is all schemes of the devil, folks. He's prowling like a lion, seeking how to devour you, your marriage, your family. Be on guard. And, you know, it's a sobering reminder from the Word of God in 1 Peter that, look, your parental rights are under attack, and your marriage and your family are under attack. So when we talk about these things and these concepts, that they're based in the Word of God and in that truth as well.
Yeah. And I think that's why we're going to see, soon a greater attack on Christianity and believers, because believers are the ones who understand that this is a spiritual war. And I think that they're also the ones, first of all, who understand that there is no utopia on earth without Christ. And that's what they're selling us. The Marxists and the communists and many other political ideologies are selling us utopia. There are no perfect outcomes. There are always only trade-offs when man is involved. That's just the reality. That's our nature. It's we can never have it perfect. Even if we have the greatest technology, even if we have robots doing everything for us, and we have a, you know, universal basic income, there are trade-offs. There are always things that are going to be lost that are maybe gained in other places that have consequences that we may not be able to understand and realize. And I think Christians and believers are at the forefront of understanding that truth. And I think that that truth is something that they are trying to cover up in a big way.
Oh, big time. And you're right. Christianity and Christians are under attack and will be under attack with increasing frequency. You know, just this past month, 4 Christians were found guilty and are awaiting sentencing for praying outside of a Nashville abortion business in Tennessee. They were found guilty of the so-called FACE law, which is the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances law. It says this law prohibits anyone from, quote-unquote, obstructing, intimidating, or interfering with a woman seeking an abortion. One of these now criminals, Christian criminals, is an elderly survivor of a communist concentration camp
Wow.
Can you believe? And she's now awaiting sentencing.
Similar persecution.
Right. For praying. Yeah. For praying. But think about that, folks. I mean, this is what we're up against. And what better way for the devil to devour and destroy and to conquer Christians than by using our own laws and our own constitution against us. So be on alert, be on guard. If you think it can't happen here in Montana, if this is a faraway thing, think again. Similar law was proposed last session here in Montana to prevent people from interfering with access. And folks, guess what? That's a part of this constitutional initiative, Constitutional Initiative 128. You can't deny or burden someone's quote unquote access to abortion. It would be enshrined in the Constitution. And let me tell you, if this passes, if this became a part of our Constitution, there will be criminal charges filed against Christians who pray outside of abortion clinics. I can almost guarantee it. And they will cite to this Tennessee instance as precedent. That's what's at stake here. It's far more than just abortion. It's an attack on parental rights. It's an attack on your faith. It's an attack on children, on the next generation. It's an attack.
Our very way of life.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, folks, as we wrap up here, I don't want to be all doom and gloom. There is great hope here as we talk about this constitutional initiative. Don't lose hope. Okay, there's 65 days as we sit here today until June 21st. And that is the deadline for Montanans securing reproductive rights to turn in their signatures. That means they've got to get about 1,000 signatures every single day. I don't see any signature gatherers out there. I think they're going to have trouble. It's cold outside. We're going to continue to pray for cold weather. But look, the fight is not over. The battle has just begun for the sanctity of life here in Montana. And, you know, as for the Montana Family Foundation, you know that we will continue in this battle. We will continue in this fight to preserve families, to preserve marriage, preserve parental rights, and to preserve children.
And if you're interested in getting involved on that, we've got multiple avenues for that. But please email me at Patrick, P-A-T-R-I-C-K, at montanafamily.org. And just let me know that you're interested. I'll get you plugged into the group in your county that's already out looking for these folks, gathering signatures and monitoring them so that we can challenge them. And, you know, have hope, because our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in John 16:33, he said, "In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world."
I love that. I love that verse. That's the God we serve. And we know that. We've read the end of the book. We're on offense here. We're on guard against the designs and the traps of the devil. We're on guard against the dangers of cultural Marxism and the dangers of the progressive ideology and the agenda to sterilize and neuter the next generation. If they don't abort a baby, they want to sterilize that baby in the name of transgender ideology. It feels like, man, you're under attack at every level. But like you said, have hope, take heart. Christ has overcome this world. We have tremendous hope in that. And, on behalf of the Montana Family Foundation, I just want to extend a big thank you to our listeners. Thank you so much. Frankly, our listenership is up like 300% just in the past week. It's an incredible movement. It's an incredible state to live in. We love Montana, and we want to keep keep Montana safe for the unborn, the preborn babies, and safe for families, safe for marriages. So if you have made it this far in the podcast, I just really would encourage you to like and subscribe to our podcast so that every time we publish a new episode each week, you get a notification that you have new content out there from the Montana Family Foundation, the Family Matters podcast. We're going to be talking about the most relevant topics, giving you updates on where things stand in the courts, in the halls of the legislature, and in the streets here in Montana. So thank you so much. Patrick, do you have anything else to add?
Nothing else. Thanks, Derek.
Well, thank you, folks. Join us again next week. Thank you, and God bless.